Good morning and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. It's the 22nd of June 2026 and I am sitting outside with not much of my book, which is the R.F. Delderfield book, The Avenue Goes to War, with me, which I intend to read for half an hour as I have a cup of coffee, probably after I've made this recording, although I'll probably upload this recording in due course. We've had some hot weather, haven't we? Yesterday was the longest day, and we've had some hot weather, and I believe we've got more in store. So that's, you know, wherever you are, I think, unless you're in a AC, what AC, air-controlled, what is it, air-controlled? No, that's not the right word, isn't it? People in different countries, in hot countries, have the AC. You have it in your car. I forget what it's called. Air-controlled. You know what I mean. I'm not a great fan of artificial air control type things, although of course it can, you know, if it's really, really hot. Actually, I enjoy the sun. I am a sun person. I'm a sun sign, I suppose, so I'm a sun person, a sun man, a man who enjoys the sun, and it's lovely to be out in the sun when you can. Obviously, in the hot of the day, sometimes if you're working hard, especially if you're doing manual work, it can be very draining, but you've got to drink plenty of water. So you've got to do it right, haven't you? But, of course, sun creams and those things, or sunscreens, as they call them, I think, are not a good idea. Because of the chemicals that they put in it, and you're putting it on the biggest organ of the body, the skin. And you see mothers and fathers lathering their children in sunscreen, and yet it is the vitamin D that you need, and the sunshine, you need that. Not just on your skin, in your eyes as well. But your skin, you don't want to block it, but people will wear sunglasses and then they'll block the sun from them, fearing that it's a bad thing, fearing. And you've got to ask yourselves, how has man survived the various thousands of years that he's been around prior to the invention of sunscreen and dark glasses? But people wear them and they've been brought up in fear that the sun will kill them or give them cancer or burn them, and you've just got to respect it when it's very, very hot. Yes, stay in the shade, but in the earlier and latter parts of the day, get out in there. They say mad dogs and Englishmen, don't they, venture out into the noonday sun, but you need a bit. Reduce the length of period that you are in the hottest part. Anyway, I'm going to smoke my pipe, which I have to clean whilst I chat to you. I hope you don't mind. I wanted to mention, I mentioned my book because I have bought a couple more R.F. Delderfields. He died so young, and it's such a shame because I think he writes so well. He writes the sort of stuff I like to read, and that is, and I've mentioned this many times, the minutiae of detail. You know, I love, I suppose it's the ordinary that I like, because we live in the ordinary. And we always see the extraordinary on the screen. And a lot of books are thrillers and things, and they are the extraordinary. And of course it's nice to have a bit of extraordinary. But what I like about the ordinary is the period that is different. That's what makes it extraordinary for me. It is extraordinary instead of extraordinary. And I'm sure I've spoken about this. Just trying to see if my pipe cleaner is in the bowl. Yes, there we go. You know, I love reading characters that go, say, on buses and buy a bus ticket and talk about the people in their trilby hats and their raincoats and the clippy and bits of conversation that's overheard on the bus. Or they go in and, you know, they're sitting there and aware that the clock on the mantelpiece is not ticking, and they get up, lay down their pipe and walk over, stroll over and look at the clock and wind it up, shake it, and think, what's the matter with this clock? You know, it's that sort of ordinariness that what people do, which normally you don't get reported in books. It draws you into the character of somebody, I think. That's what I like. And it's what I would like to write as well, within the story that obviously grips. When I say grips, it doesn't got to be an adventure that is beyond people's comprehension, you know, or not comprehension, but experience. I have bought, I think the one I have bought is, I haven't got them with me here. I'm not sitting in my front room. And I'm just trying to think what they are. One of them is something like Charlie Come Home and Face the Music or something. And I believe it's about somebody who is working at a company, is privy to some security of the company loophole and is able to rob the company and get away with it, and nobody suspects him, but actually there is something that he's left a clanger, as it were. And I think it's like years later that he goes back and he realises he's got to remove this clanger, whatever it is. I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to remember what the little precy on the back said. And if that's not quite right, actually, that is quite a nice little story that you commit a crime. This character commits a crime. Gets away with it for years, but then wakes up in a cold sweat and remembers one detail, that if somebody opens a certain safe, or if somebody opens a file or calculates a certain thing, it will all come back to him, or something like that, you know. And it's years later and he's got away with it, and the chances are nobody ever will, but it plagues him as he spends the money, and so he has to go back and tries to get this file removed, or this bit of evidence, or whatever it is that he left behind, a packet of cigarettes, or, you know, a bus ticket, a receipt that fell out his pocket. And that takes a bit of doing to get back in and to do it, and then, you know, you decide whether he gets caught or not in the story. I mean, I don't know what the plot is, other than I'm now plotting a book that probably doesn't exist, and that's me and my imagination. And so that was one. I also got, he wrote, R.F. Delderfield wrote God is an Englishman, and I read that, and that's quite a big saga, and he wrote three books on that, and there's two more which I've got. I forget what they're called. One I think is called something like In Which We Serve, and that's not to be confused with the one that is To Serve Them All Their Days, which is the one about the public school, which is one of his more famous ones because it was made into a TV series. And then the last one, I can't remember what that one's called off the top of my head, but that is 900, I think it's 900 pages. He lost himself in his writing. He was continually moving. I read his biography, and he was continually moving about in Devon. I had a fascinating life, writing most of it on newspapers and things, but and plays. He wrote plays and was involved in going up to London from Devon to go and watch the plays being rehearsed and then making changes and bits and pieces on the thing. And he hated all that going into London. At first he quite loved the scene, and then in the end he didn't like it at all, and he decided, I'm not going to get involved in any of that. And he would write for 6 hours a day in his writing room and tapping away on a typewriter. It is quite incredible. But then when you think of other writers, Dickens, you know, prior to that, they were all writing in longhand. Were they? When was the typewriter invented? But yes, I mean, many of them were writing in longhand, and then it was from the longhand edition to the typesetter, or not so much the typesetter, but the printer who was pulling the type, the metal type from the little bay of boxes as they set up the printer. I mean, it incredible, really. And such dedication. Light this pipe. I'll fill it first. I'm still on Red Lion, which is a nice, gentle English tobacco. This pipe is relatively got a largish bowl on it, deep bowl, I would say. It's a sort of almost like a chimney. This, I don't know that it is a chimney, but it's almost like one. And chimney, I believe, is a style of pipe. I hope I brought my lighter. That's the thing I didn't. Oh, I did. I also bought two books by J.B. Priestley. I like J.B. Priestley, his novels, and I haven't read that many. But I do quite like him. Again, I mean, he's famed for plays, of course. He also wrote that one about travelling around England, and I read that in on one of my YouTube channels for some years ago now, where he was travelling up and down in the 1930s looking at the state of England. That was fascinating, really fascinating. But he's a very theatrical chap, and he was writing about theatrical things. So one, I think, is about a film script. The character's writing a film script or something, and I don't know what happens. I haven't read it. I'm not quite sure what the other one is, and I can't even remember the name of the... One's called Bright Days. I think it's called Bright Days. Looks like a nice, interesting book. He, J.B. Priestley, of course, wrote The Good Companions. I read that. That's an interesting ensemble piece about travelling actors. And then he wrote another one, which is a similar sort of thing, travelling actors, called Lost Empires. And at first I thought, oh, is it about civilizations that have disappeared? You know, I had no idea when I think that was the first J.B. Priestley book I read. And because he's talking about theatres, the Empire Theatre, and all these other different types of theatre, but, you know, Lost Empires, of how it was, they were basically changing from the type of stuff they did and how theatre was disappearing. And that lifestyle of the travelling. I can't remember if it was about vaudeville act now, but it was a lot of travelling from pillar to post and staying in these lodging houses that people used to do. I guess people still do them now, but they might be Airbnbs and things like that these days. But back in those days, people stayed with these widowed women, or I suppose spinsters, who had, for whatever reason, either been left a house, or it was, you know, they grew up in that house and their parents died, and they were spinsters, or they were widows, as I say, and so they were left the house with several rooms, and they would let the rooms to the travelling theatre people. And again, a fascinating life, and so the characters, I can't remember the main thrust of the story, but they, I just found, again, it's that minutiae of everydayness that I thoroughly enjoy, and experience the sort of a lifestyle that you don't experience now. Or that's what I think fiction is so good at. Yes, you can have the fiction of the adventurer, the Clive Cussler type books, in which people travel, you know, almost like the James Bond sort of adventure type people who are doing fantastic things. And I've read a few of those, and they're, you know, at a certain time in life, you read those things for the adventure of it. You don't get the detail of everydayness, because it's not really about everyday. It's about nuclear bombs being disarmed or stolen or whatever, and, you know, fantastic things. Whereas people and their lives is what fascinates me, I suppose. And the characterizations and the, you know, the oddness. So that's what I like. And that idea of these people staying with these often stingy boarding houses with the woman, what do they call, the landlady, you know, who would cook for them a couple of kippers in the morning, or they would do something at night time, you know, for an extra shilling or whatever it was. I just find that quite fascinating, and the sort of foods that they would cook, and because a lot of women didn't go out to work back in the sort of 30s and before the war, and so they're keeping their house, and they don't have all the modern appliances, of course, that we do, and so that's fascinating too, how they're making ends meet, and, you know, they're getting out the carpet sweeper, and I just find all that really interesting, because it's of a period. But what's, I suppose, also interesting is these books were written in that period, so that the people in that period of time, so, you know, R.F. Delafield may have released a book in, say, the 1950s, talking about 1950s life, it would have seemed quite normal to people in the 1950s about bus tickets and carriage clocks and, you know, people going into work. And it's, of course, it's all very British. It's very British. Everybody is... the culture is recognised all the way through. There's not the diversity of different cultures that one has to sort of negotiate now if one's writing and try and either incorporate, or if you don't incorporate, you may be slandered as racist or something because you haven't given a realistic picture of the time. I mean, that's the nice thing about that sort of period. You're reading about the culture of the time. And the attitudes, and sometimes words come up that you couldn't use today, but that was perfectly normal used in those days. And I think that's, again, it's fascinating. But what I was going on to say is that I think it's interesting that people of the time would have read those books and not thought it was unusual. Sorry if there's wind coming on the microphone, apologies for that. Suddenly a little gust came up then. They wouldn't have found it unusual to be talking about carriage clocks and bus tickets and things, because that would be their life experience. And I suppose that's really nice to know, in as much as it would, the books are not highlighting a life, a lifestyle or a culture that wasn't true, because people would not have bought the books if it was too much over the top. In other words, what I'm saying is you get history books in which somebody will research and say, this is what happened and this is what happened. And that's fine to a degree. But they're writing from the future, looking back, as it were, or they're writing from the present, looking back. But a fiction story, if it's writing, the story arc may be extraordinary, but if it was written for the period that, i.e., people in the 40s were reading a book that was written in the 40s, it would seem extraordinary or odd if what they're telling you about buses and timetables and you know, what's available in the shop and kippers for breakfast and all that detail, if that was not true. So in other words, what I'm trying to get to is that sometimes fiction that's been written in that period is very useful, because it is a true representation of what would normally go on. It has to be, doesn't it? Because people would go, well, that's an extraordinary, you know, the story might be different, but it's the setting. Gosh, it took me a long time to say that. So yes, 2 J.B. Priestleys and 3 R.F. Delderfields have been purchased, and absolutely lovely. And I'm so desperate to get back in between doing the work on Biggleswick Farm, and just getting the place cleared, and vegetable beds sorted and whatever else we need, like with the polytunnel and things, so that is a relatively relatively easy task in the daytime to get on with, and then in the morning and perhaps in the evenings to write. And whether I'm at home or staying over, it would be nice just to be able to have that opportunity to write. One of the things that we are also doing is, we obviously love it at Biggleswick Farm, and to find a nearby house that I could sell my house and have within a couple of miles distance of, you know, that's the big plan. And we've been keeping our eye out, of course, for a suitable place. I don't want to get a mortgage, so I've got to be able to, whatever I can get for my house would be all I would have available to purchase another house. So I mean, that's the sensible plan, and everything is a bit up in the air at the moment. And of course, there are certain little places you think, oh, if one of those houses came up for sale, that would be perfect. But they haven't as yet. I mean, our main focus has been trying to just get the clearance stuff done. I mean, this, as you will know, there's brambles and thistles. And even though last year we did quite a bit, we're using mostly hand tools. And you know, it's tricky, because you you get a certain area done and you think, right, we're going to do that. I'll do that next year and I'll do that the following year or whatever. Or those trees will have to come down at some point because they're going to fall down. And then you're working on something else. And the bit you did last year, suddenly you look at it and you go, my God, it's all grown back. So it's very hard to keep on top of it. And one needs to invest in some good, perhaps a few power tools just to help you, like with the tractor and things like that. But of course, you've got to store them somewhere where if you're not on the land all the time, you're open for them to disappear, aren't they? So the ideal solution is to find a house. So that's the obvious plan, and that's what we're trying to do. But like everything, everything happens in its own time, in its right time, and it will happen, I am sure. It doesn't actually have to be a very large house. It doesn't have to be too wonderful, because we just come over here and get on and do the work. And you know, even in the mornings or early evenings, to be able to sit and do a bit of writing and then head back home to the house would be great, so that you can have a bath and, you know, do all the things that you do. Whereas at the moment, the commute is just, I mean, it's ridiculous. But you try finding a piece of land that is near where you live, that is the price that you've got. I mean, you have to go, it's like a job, isn't it? When you're looking for work, you look for work, and sometimes the job is an hour away, 2 hours away. People commute to their work. The land isn't there to make us money. It's there to grow us food, to save us money, I suppose. It's an investment in the actual land itself, I suppose. But it's not going to give much of a return if it's just food. But it's a lifestyle, isn't it? It's being able to be out in the country and keeping fit and growing some food. And then if I can get my writing going, that would be fantastic. I know people, and then it's true, you don't really make much money as a writer. But I have a passion for it, and I think it's important to follow your passion. That's what I think we're here on this strange planet, this beautiful planet, this existence, whatever it is to enjoy and work out what your passions are. Anyway, there, random thoughts, or not so random really. So that's what we've got to try and do, is because you can't commute unless you're being paid to do it, can you? Especially at the moment with the price of diesel. I mean, it's ridiculous. So anyway, that's what we're doing. And this is only the first year where we're trying to work out throughout the year, I think, whether we're enjoying what we're doing here. You're exploring where the sun goes, you're exploring what plants grow, you're exploring what you can grow yourself, you're challenging yourself with things like building a polytunnel from just the materials on the land, the learning about the different plants or vegetables that you're growing and the seasons and things, whether you are able physically to do it throughout the year. You know, the first year is a test, isn't it? It's a test to go at the end of it. Do we want to carry on, or should we just sell it up and do something else? I don't think that's going to be the case, to be honest with you. We've thoroughly enjoyed this. It has been challenging. There are challenges. The weather, of course, is one, but it has been so far, and we're not yet at the end of the year, and this, I think you need another year really, because there's so much to set up in the first year. But anyway, I see their chemtrailing like buggery in the sky, so I shall leave you for a bit and have a read of R.F. Delderfield. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.